Last week here, as we're working on dispensations, we were on the dispensation of human government. The Orth kids, I told them they could leave it up for a week. Any kids that want to help disassemble that today, I'll show you, I'll explain that to you after a while. I've got the, Lindsay brought the stuff back. But we let them keep up the Tower of Babel one more week. So that was their, that was one of their projects that they were doing. And I apologize, I racked my brain. I'm not great at teaching kids, and I had a real tough time trying to come up with what would be a good thing to share today, specifically about the dispensation of promise as a lead-in for where we're going. So I apologize, I don't have anything like that, and I realize that some of you adults, that's the, you get the most out of that probably. Hopefully that's not the case, but sometimes maybe that communicates better than everything else we go over. But today we're going to be moving into the dispensation of promise. And now you finally actually have the correct outline. I don't know how I didn't notice this when I printed it off. But as we look at the dispensation of promise and what's involved in this, we're looking at a period of time that goes from the call of Abraham until the giving of the law. So we've been through, this is our fourth dispensation. So we looked at the dispensation of Eden's back at the time, innocence back at the time of Eden, from the time that Adam and Eve left the garden up until the flood, the dispensation of conscience after that, and then from the time after the flood till the call of Abraham, we looked at the dispensation of human government. So these are the major events, and now we're going from the call of Abraham until we get to the time of the law, and it's a dispensation of promise. And so just kind of giving you a picture in terms of where we are in our dispensations as we're looking at these things. Moving into the dispensation of promise, God's made promises at other time, but God's going to make a lot of promises in this particular dispensation that are going to set these off. And they're going to be promises that are going to rest on God's shoulders primarily, not on people. When we get to back up here, when we get to the dispensation of law, there are also a lot of promises that God makes Israel under the law. But their promises under the law rest on their shoulders, in part. God's the one that will fulfill the promise, but the promises are contingent on Israel obeying. Whereas under this dispensation, there is not an issue of obedience in particular with some of these promises, and we will kind of try to draw some of that out. So we're going to go through part of our outline today, and then we'll come back next week, we'll finish it up. And then I also want to probably take a week and talk about some different interesting issues that go on in this dispensation that we haven't tackled in the just the main information about this. So, as always, we start off by asking ourselves this question. Well, the time frame on here, I said to Sinai, but I actually always kind of take the this dispensation of promise, I would actually say it even goes as far as the time of Kadesh Barnea, because that's actually kind of when they really show fully their doubt in God's promise of the land when they get to Kadesh Barnea. And if you don't know what happens at Kadesh Barnea, that's when they send the 10 or the 12 spies into the land to spy it out, and 10 come back and give a bad report, and the majority of the people vote to go with the bad report of the 10 spies. And so they doubt God. And that's, of course, that's looking at what the failure of this dispensation is. It's kind of getting us ahead in where the outline is. But the whole issue is, when you doubt a promise, what are you really doubting? You're really doubting God. If I make a promise to you and you walk away going, oh, I'll believe it when I see it, what are you really saying? I don't think Tim's going to do that. It's not that, oh, I think that's a ridiculous promise. It's really, Tim won't keep up what he said. Tim won't do what he said. And so likewise, if a person really doubts a promise from God, then they're really doubting God. So we're going to start over in Genesis chapter 12 this morning. We're going to go through some reasons why God is the owner. We said this at the outset, God is the owner of every household. In fact, if we were to ask you the question, is there a passage in Scripture that would say that God is the owner of every household, where would you go? Does anybody know of a passage that you would go to that really tells us that? Hebrews chapter 3. Just keep your finger in Genesis 12, and let's just remind ourselves of this. Hebrews 3, we haven't been there for a few weeks, so it'd be good to remind ourselves. Hebrews chapter 3, when he's talking about, really contrasting the household in which we live to the household of Israel, and he says in verse 2, he was faithful to him who appointed him, that's Jesus Christ, as Moses also was in all of his household, for he has been counted worthy of more glory than Moses by just so much as the builder of the house has more honor than the house. So he's saying Christ is the builder of the house. He has more honor. For every house is built by someone, and the builder of all things is God. And in this context, the builder of all things is referring to households. So God's the builder of all these households. He's the owner. Okay, he's the master of the house. So in Genesis chapter 12, then this morning, we see that now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to a land which I will show you. So we start right off in verse 1 that this dispensation starts with God calling Abraham to leave that part of the world where he is, where they're across the Fertile Crescent over on the east side, not too far probably from where the Tower of Babel, those events took place. They're not tremendously at long distance from there. And he's calling him to leave. Now, we're not looking at this today, but just to kind of put you in mind of this, we're told by in the book of Joshua, as well as over in the book of Acts, that Abraham comes out of a family of idolaters. So it's not as though God says, well, I'm going to choose this Abraham because he is a really distinguished man, because he, their family, really, they're all in for me. He's going to come and he's going to choose this man. He's going to do something with this man, and he's going to make promises to this man and his family. And he's not going to do so because they were noble people. He comes from a family of idolaters, and we'll come back to that and deal with that here in a couple of weeks. That's one of those things I want to spend some time on. Verse 2, and I will make and this is in there, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And so God is the one that's making the promises to Abraham. He's the one that's calling and initiating these matters, because God's the owner of the house in this. If you turn over to chapter 13, chapter 13 and verse 16, we're going to go back to verse 14. It says, and the Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes, look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, and westward, for all the land which you see, I will give to you and to your descendants forever, and I will make your descendants like the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. As my wife pointed out this week when she was talking to me about this, I think we probably, where we live here, we have a distinct appreciation for dust in a way that others may not. I grew up in a place where, yes, we had dust, but you and I live in a really dusty place, especially when the wind blows endless days in a row. We have a lot of this. And so the idea that if you could, he's not saying your children will be equivalent to the amount of dust in the earth, but the idea is if you could count all the bits of dust in the earth, you could count your family. So he's really saying, you can't count the dust, and you're not going to be able to count all your kids. This is what he is trying to get at, trying to make this point to Abraham. Again, making a promise at this moment in time. And then we get over to chapter 15. This is after Abraham has returned from the War of the Kings, where he's gone to rescue his nephew Lot. And he goes off with his small hired army that he has, their private army that he owns. And when they return, he realizes he has no heir. Not his own personal heir. His heir is Eliezer of Damascus. So when he's gone, this servant of his is going to inherit everything that he has. And so he says, verse 5, he appears to him at night. He comes to, says to come outside the tent, took him outside and said, now look toward the heavens and count the stars. Now this is similar to what he said back in chapter 13, if you can count the dust. But now he says, look and count the stars. If you're able to count them, he says, if you're able to count, and to count the stars, if you're able to count them, and he said to them, so shall your descendants be. So in other words, the number of his descendants, one is like, it's going to be like trying to count the dust of the earth. Secondly, in this next promise he makes, that it's going to be like the stars of heaven. Do want to bring in here, although this isn't going to be our focus at the moment, but it does say in verse 6, and then he believed the Lord, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. This is very important because the New Testament always goes back to this statement for the time in which Abraham was declared righteous before God. Not in Genesis 12, not in Genesis 13, but here in Genesis 15. Now, does Abraham show some faith when he leaves the land to go to this place? The book of Hebrews tells us so, but it's apparently not the same kind of faith by which God justifies Abraham, because that is always based on this statement here. And that's, again, trying to decide where to go and how much to stay with this. But this is just to bring this home for us. When God tells Abraham, I want you to leave your family and I'm going to take you to a land and I'm going to set you up over in that land and I'm going to make a nation out of you. At that time, Abraham is still just young enough that Abraham probably in his mind is thinking, well, maybe this could happen. And he looks around and he goes, and there's a lot of land and a lot of places. And how do I know that there won't be? It's very likely that there could be some land that could be mine. But by the time that God appears to Abraham here in Genesis 15, and he promises him not the land, but specifically is promising him that your children are going to be innumerable. And Abraham and Sarah by this time are getting on in age, and Abraham is starting to, he could start to, from a human perspective, to go, I'm not so sure about this. What Abraham is demonstrating at this point is a kind of faith that doesn't have its basis in any way in something visible, something that I can tangibly handle out there. And I want you to take your Bibles and turn over to the book of Romans in chapter 4. Romans chapter 4. In Romans chapter 4, in the first part of the chapter, it tells us in verse 3, verse 2, it says, for if Abraham was justified or declared righteous by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. For what does the scriptures say? Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness. So it sets this down. But now it's going to actually go on, and it's going to say something about how he is related to us in this matter. And so it says, let's go to verse 16. It says, for this reason, then, it is by faith, that is the promise, what God has is by faith, so that it can be according to grace. See, Paul is now connecting Abraham's example of what happened, connecting it to a situation in which we find ourselves, as opposed to the law, in order that the promise may be certain to all the descendants, not just those who are from the law, but to those who are of the kind of faith of Abraham, he says, who is a, now our Bibles do not say the father of us all. In the Greek, there's no the in front of father. He's a quality or a kind of father of us all. In what way is he a kind of father? Well, it goes on and it says, verse 17, as it is written, a father of many nations have I made you in the sight of him who believed, even God who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist, literally in hope and upon hope. Now, that's the way we have it written, but literally in the Greek, it's beyond hope and upon hope. In other words, beyond hope is because he says he believed in order that he might become the father of many nations according to that which has been spoken, so shall your descendants be. And without becoming weak in faith, he contemplated his own body, now as good as dead, since he was about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. Yet with respect to the promise of God, he did not waver in unbelief, but grew strong in faith, giving glory to God. In other words, he says, Abraham did not have any concrete reason to believe this promise from God. If he weighed the evidence was not in favor of God's promise from a human point of view. And so in that regard, he says in verse 18 that Abraham was beyond hope, but also upon hope. In other words, he was at a place where he was beyond or past or beside any kind of hope that was realistic. But he did what he did believe was based upon hope. And it's in that way then that Paul is able to say that he is a kind of father of us, because the kind of faith that you and I, now this brings us home, so think about this as we're going through these promises today, the kind of hope and faith that you and I are, the kind of faith we are to have, is a faith that is not based on concrete evidence. We are not those that are pulling Gideon. We are not those that are to say, okay, God, you want me to do this. First of all, burn up my offering. Okay, well, you did that. Okay, that was an easy one. I've got this, and I always get these mixed up. I don't know what order, but here's some wool, some fleece. Make it wet, keep the ground dry. Oh, you did that. Okay. Well, oh, hey, make the ground wet and the fleece dry. Three times, God counters Gideon's doubt with a concrete activity to prove that this is what he's supposed to do. And this was true for many people throughout history, but for you and I, we are those that are to walk by faith and not by sight, as Paul says over in the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 5. So with this then, if we go back over to Genesis chapter 15, as we're thinking of God being the one that sets, he's the master of this house, he's the one that makes these promises to Abraham, and he makes promises, this one in particular here, for which there's no good reason that Abraham should believe it. Abraham doesn't go, oh yeah, that makes sense. Because, pardon me, I don't mean to be, but my wife's still ovulating and I'm still strong. And oh yeah, we can have kids. No problem. We'll have kids. Okay, you can do this. Abraham does that. Book of Romans tells us, hey, he looked at it as, we're as good as dead. That's the way Paul pictured it. This isn't possible. And so, it says in verse 6, and then he believed the Lord. And that word believe is the Hebrew word aman. We say amen in English. But that was a word that literally meant to say well supported. Structure. Strong. It pictured something that had structure to it and it was strong and you could support it. And you'd look at that and he looks at that and he says, Lord, you, this is what he's doing. You are the structure to this promise. It's not that there's other structure in the promise. It's that you're the one behind this. That's the kind of faith we're supposed to have, by the way. Which is, I think, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, where he talks about we live by faith, not by sight. When Paul actually makes that comment, as much as we quote him in defense of how we're supposed to live, that's actually a hard thing, and that's exactly Paul's point there in 2 Corinthians 5. Paul's admitting, living by faith, not by sight, is not an easy thing to do. Because we all want good evidence before we act, right? Now, look at the end of Genesis 15. Pardon me, I'll get the right passage. The end of Genesis 15, he also now is going to make a promise to him about land. We saw that talking about land way over there in chapter 12. Again, he makes a promise of land in chapter 13. But we get down here to the end of chapter 15, and he says in verse 18, on that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. Now, we talked about covenants early on in this study, but a covenant is a contract. And it's a promise in the form of a contract. Now, that contract can be either unilateral or bilateral. Okay? Hannah, you know what unilateral and bilateral mean? You guys talked about it. Peggy, you're not dropping the ball in your Sunday school class. No. I'm just kidding. Okay. Those are big fancy words we used to say that sometimes you make a promise and only one person has to keep the promise. And sometimes you make a promise and both parts have something they have to do. Now, when we get to the law, God's going to make promises in which he says, I will hold up my end of the deal, but you have to obey. And when you obey, then I will provide these things for you. But when we come to Genesis chapter 15, Abraham's sound asleep during all of this. We went over this back several weeks ago, so I'm not trying not to go through everything. But the Lord comes here and he makes a covenant. And only God bears the responsibility of his covenant. Abraham does not. He says, with Abraham, saying, to your descendants or your seed I have given this land from the river of Egypt as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite. In other words, you're going to get all their land. And Abraham, by this time, is over in that part of the land. I'm sure he's becoming very familiar with all these people that he's living among them. They're all surrounding him, set up in their cities, because that's the way they lived. They'd build a small city, you'd put a wall around it, and then you'd have all these farmers that would farm outside the walls of the city. And whenever there was an attack or a war, they'd grab their livestock and their families, and they'd all run inside the city and shut the gates, and now you're protected and you can defend yourself. And so you've got all these cities surrounding this area where Abraham is living. Abraham, by the way, is not living in a city. He's living in a tent. Okay. In fact, the book of Genesis or the book of Hebrews 11 says he's living in tents during all of this time. But God makes this promise to him. He also, if you flip over to chapter 17, he also promises him some additional specific land. In Genesis 17 and verse 8, and I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. Now, when he was talking about the land in Genesis 15, he's talking about a much larger piece of land than the land of Canaan. And it's important for us to understand that he's talking about two different pieces of land. They did end up possessing the land of Canaan in Genesis 17, but they have never possessed all the land God promised him in Genesis 15. And since that was a one-sided promise, there was nothing for Abraham to do. God says, I'm going to do this. He doesn't even tell Abraham, you got to believe this or I won't do it. He just says, I'm going to do it. And since that hasn't happened yet, and that promise rests on whose shoulders? It rests on God's shoulders. Can we expect or should we expect that that promise will be fulfilled? Yes. That promise is yet to be fulfilled. There is a time coming in which God will give Israel. I'm not saying particularly the nation that's over there right now. This is the Israel that will yet be in the future after Daniel's 70th week, after we've gone and Daniel's 70th week has taken place out there in what we know as the kingdom, or the first 1,000 years of that kingdom. It's in that time that they will inherit this land. So God is the owner of this household. Abraham, on the other hand, Abraham is the manager or the steward. And so right here in Genesis chapter 17, we see that the promises, we've already seen Abraham's receiving these promises, but we want to see that they're going to be extended to others. And so in Genesis chapter 17, and look at with me at verse 18, and Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. Now remember, for those of us that maybe have kind of forgotten, who is Ishmael? He is Abraham's son by Hagar. Hagar is an Egyptian maid to, not a maid that cleans the house, somebody that attends, like a person, think of a personal attendant to Sarah. Which again reminds us, for her to have a personal attendant, again reminds us, Abraham's not a nobody in terms of his possessions. I mean, he has a private army of 300 fighting men. That's a pretty substantial holding just right there. But he has this, and the solution that Sarah comes up with, remember, is, hey, I'm too old to have kids for you. This is not likely. Hey, let's try Hagar. And so she is going to get, and this was not an uncommon thing, by the way. The same thing ends up happening with his grandson, Jacob, with his two wives, Rachel and Leah, that he has some children through Rachel and Leah and some through Rachel and Leah's maids, okay? And so this was not an uncommon thing in their world for you to have children both through your wife as well as through secondary wives in the name of your wife, which to us sounds really bizarre. It's their culture. It's not the way God wants us to do it today. So Abraham says, how about Ishmael? Now, I don't know, is Abraham expressing doubt when he says this? I'm wondering if he isn't expressing some doubt, because maybe Abraham's going, man, it's just not likely. I've already got a son, Ishmael, by Hagar. Won't he be good enough? But he says here in verse 19, God said, no, But Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac, and I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. In other words, he says Isaac's going to be the one, not Ishmael. And I think that this is always important. We're going to kind of come back and revisit this here in just a few minutes. And so he extends it through Isaac. Turn over to chapter 26, Genesis chapter 26. Genesis chapter 26, look with me beginning in verse 1. It says, now there was a famine in the land beside the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. This had been south and west of where Abraham and his family were living. And the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land. Sojourn means this isn't your home yet. You're going to a place, this isn't your home, Isaac, just to make sure we're clear. And I will be with you and bless you, for to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. So very clearly he says in verse 3, he says, I am giving you this land, and so Isaac stay here. So he only let him go as far as the land of the Philistines, which is just a little southwest of where they were living. But he definitely is saying that this promise, this is for you. It's not for your brother Ishmael. God established that way back there in Genesis chapter 17. And then this is extended further to Jacob. And so if you turn over to Genesis chapter 32, Genesis 32, and in Genesis 32 and verse 30, this is when Jacob is, if you remember, is running away, or is in the process, is returning back to the land. And it says in verse 30, so Jacob named the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved. And so he actually had this encounter with God the Son, in which God the Son appears to him in a physical form, and he wrestles with him all night long. But it's not Esau. Esau is not the one that's going to get this. Because remember, Jacob's wife Rachel, or Isaac's wife Rachel, still not getting it right. Rebecca, Isaac's wife Rebecca, has two sons, has twins. And so in chapter 28, Genesis chapter 28, look with me beginning in verse 13. This is when Jacob is leaving, running from his brother because he stole his brother's birthright. He kind of fears his brother. Jacob's a guy that lives in tents, and his brother is a man of the field. His brother's the hunter. He likes to be out and about. And Jacob likes to stay in the tent. Okay, so you got two different personalities, and Jacob very likely probably fears his brother because his brother probably is a little bit more of a rugged guy. And he doesn't know what to expect. And so in the midst of all of this, as he is running away here, trying to make sure I'm getting the right verse here, chapter 28, beginning with verse 13. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord. This is a dream he's having, but I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. So he's trying to say, I'm the same God. Which, by the way, is telling you something. We'll talk about this maybe later, but I think that God has to really distinguish himself because these are people that are living among Jacob, Esau, Abraham. They're all living Jacob, Isaac, Abraham. And my mind is kind of crazy today. But they're living in a land where everybody around them are worshiping idols. They're people that are polytheists. They believe in many gods. And God has to continue to try to present himself that I'm the same God that appeared to Abraham. I'm the same God that appeared to your father Isaac. He wants them to know I'm one and the same God. I'm not a different God in this place because oftentimes they associated God with places. You know, we support and pray for Josh and Faye down there in Papua New Guinea, and Josh and Faye will tell you that the people there, well, there's a God that lives in those rocks over there, and there's another deity that's in that stream over there, and there's one that's over there in the sun, and another one in the moon. See, so they have to try to, when they're teaching those people about Jesus Christ, they have to try to explain to those people, there is one God that created everything. Abraham and his family have lived in this kind of land. So Jacob now, as he is running from his brother and God appears to him, God has to say to them, I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham, the God of Isaac. The land in which you lie, I will give it to you and to your descendants. Your descendants shall also be like the dust of the earth. Promise that God had made to Abraham. And you shall spread out to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. In you and in your descendants shall all families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. And so God extends the promise that he's made to Abraham, the promise that he's made to Isaac. He is now extending that very same promise to Jacob in this regard. And he doesn't do so through Esau. Esau is not the one. Now, there's one last guy that I want to bring in here. And the promise isn't given specifically to him. It's given to him because he's part of the family. And his name is Joseph. And so if you turn over to the book of Genesis in chapter 45. Most of us, if you haven't, how many of you are trying to read through the Bible this year? How many of you are trying to do that? Okay. Well, there's a couple of you. If you're trying to do that, there's a good chance you probably read through the book of Genesis by now. And if you're reading through Genesis, you know, most of us maybe are familiar with Joseph, that he is he's the one that God's chosen to lead, shall we say, the people to Egypt. He's the one that's going to get them down there and protect them. That's God's plan. And when things transpire and there's a famine and the family is forced to go down there to land, eventually when they find out that this Egyptian that they're dealing with is Joseph, he figures this out early on who they are. But when it comes down to being Joseph, they're kind of afraid. Well, they did him some dirt, remember? Could you imagine what you'd be like to your brothers under normal human circumstances if they'd taken you and roughed you up, actually were planning on killing you, that's what they were going to do, until the big brother, Reuben, comes along and intercedes on him. And he says, no, we're not going to kill him. And he's hoping that he can kind of win his freedom. And in the meantime, I can't even think what their names are right now. But anyway, but there's traders that are traveling through the land, and they see him, and they go, instead of killing our brother, let's sell him as a slave. We can make some money off him rather than just doing him in and burying his body out here. And so they sell him, and by the time Reuben gets back, it's already gone. His brother's gone. They've got the money in hand, and Joseph is sold into slavery. And his time in slavery down there is kind of an up-and-down roller coaster ride. Some really bad experiences, as well as seeing God do some good things. All of this to say, if you found out that this was your brother and he's like the second most powerful man in Egypt, you'd be thinking, oh man, we are all dead. We are dead where we stand. But Genesis chapter 45, beginning with verse 5, it says, now, do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me. No, he looks at this. He looked at this in a positive way. Tim Kimmel in the class that Ben's been teaching and I filled in this morning, he was talking today about people that operate and live in a scarcity mentality or an abundance mentality. Do you live with your hands closed and tight, holding on to whatever things it is, your time, your life, your resources, or do you live with your life with your hands open like this? Well, look at David here. David looks at this thing and he doesn't go, you guys sold me into slavery. Joseph, what did I say? Jacob, did I? It says, for God sent me here. See, that's a hands open kind of thing. He says, you guys sold me into slavery, but God's the one that brought me here. See, he's able to look at his situation. He looks at it very differently. He says, for God is the one that has brought me here. Brought me here before you to preserve life. For the famine in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting, and God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth to keep you alive by a great deliverance. And David's able to look at what God's doing. He's able to see the promise that God made to his great-grandfather Abraham, to his grandfather Isaac, to his father Jacob, and now extending that promise to the rest of them, he's able to see this is what God's plan is for us. Turn to the end of the book of Genesis and turn to chapter 50. Chapter 50 and verse 19. This is after dad's died. You see, even though Joseph has said this to them before, and even though Joseph has been very kind to them, the minute their dad has passed away, the boys are thinking, oh, now is when the claws come out. Now is when the other shoe is going to fall. Up to now, he's been nice because of dad. But now dad's gone. This is it. Verse 18, then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. See, this is the way you're trying to save yourself, save face maybe in this. But Joseph said to them, do not be afraid. For am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me. God meant it for good, in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. But he's able to look at this in verse 20 as though God orchestrated all of this. Because Joseph is demonstrating a confidence in God's plan and God's promise to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, and now extended to he and his brothers. And he's able to see that God's given him a role in this. And I think that's a really important thing to demonstrate, because he's actually a demonstration of believing the promise, so much so that if you were to go down to the last verses of this, verse 25 of chapter 50, then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, that's to swear an oath, saying, you will surely take care of, or God will surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones up from here. And when you get over to Israel leaving the land of Egypt, among all the other things it says in Moses, took with them the bones of Joseph. All the while that they're traveling the wilderness, they have these bones that they're carrying of Joseph, which are in part a testimony to one man's confidence, one man's faith that God will give them that land. And when he's going to be resurrected, Joseph wanted to be resurrected in that land. Not that God, if he would have been resurrected in Egypt, that it would have been anything else, but it really shows you his confidence. Okay? So Abraham then is the manager's steward. It's through Isaac, not Ishmael. It's through Jacob, not Esau. Only those then, and I think it's important for us to understand that this covenant promise, these promises are made only to those that are descended from Isaac, only those descended from Jacob or Israel, as his name ends up becoming. And that's important for us to understand. Did God make promises to Ishmael? Yeah, he made promises to Ishmael. God doesn't kick him to the curb and say, no, nothing for you, but he doesn't make these special promises to Ishmael. Does he make promises to Esau and his people? Yeah, he made promises to Esau and his people also, but they're not the promises that God had for the nation Israel in this regard. So, the rule then, as we're understanding this, and as we're kind of talking about who the family was and who the steward was, we want to talk about what is the rule. And the rule that they have at this time is to live by faith, to live in anticipation of these promises that God's made. So let's go back to Genesis chapter 15. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 15 and notice this is as God's getting prepared, God is preparing, having Abraham get the things ready to make this covenant in verse 13. And God said to Abraham, know for certain. Now, this is a promise. Doesn't sound like a very great promise, but it's a promise. Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will judge that nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. But notice, they should have been able to count that up and go, we've been here this long. They should have been directing faith, going, God made us a promise he was going to take us out of this land. I would have been marking the days on the calendar. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'd like to think if I were them, I would have been marking the days on a calendar. But I probably would have ended up being like them and going, oh, God forgot us down here in Egypt. Because that ends up what you find when we end up getting to the book of Exodus at that time. So they were to believe this at that time. They should have believed that God was going to judge the nation where they were living. We saw that there in verse 14. And they should have then believed in verse 16, then in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the perversity of the Amorite is not yet complete. So as he looks at this, he says, hey, there's a time God's going to bring you back. And they should have believed that promise. So their lives are to be lived in light of God's promise to them of bringing them back to the land. So, just review. God's the steward, as always. Number two, God's the owner. Man, God is the owner. Abraham is the steward in this, the manager. The family are the descendants of Abraham through Isaac and through Jacob, not Ishmael and not Esau. And the way of life is really to be lived, is just for them to live or to believe the promises that God's made to them with regard to this. Those promises, the faith in those promises are exemplified as we kind of took a short look at was Joseph that says, hey, when you go up from here, take my bones back. He's confident that God will raise them. Those promises are exemplified eventually, and we'll come back to this next week, in Joshua and Caleb, who say, God promised us the land. We can take these people. We can take this land. Because this was what God promised to them. They could have believed those promises, but they didn't believe those promises, and as a result, they end up grumbling and complaining when you get over to the book of Exodus. We're going to save that for next week and come back to that. Okay. So, God's the owner, Abraham's the manager, the household is the family of Israel, and the rule of life is really living by faith with regard to God's promises that he's making them. Father, we're thankful for the time that you've given us together in your word. Help us to remember you've made great promises to us. In fact, as Peter said, you've actually made to us the greatest promises. And as we stop and we think about those greatest promises that you've made to us, we realize that like Israel, we too are to believe those promises. We're to focus on those promises. And we're to believe that you're capable of fulfilling these things for us. And sometimes we, like them, we get so wrapped up in life and we get so focused on the downside of things that we don't live by faith. We don't expect your abundance in our life. We expect you to just make us undergo a lot of hardships, difficulties, and we can be like Israel and we can grumble. Help us not to be like that. Help us to be those that would actually exhibit joy that the Spirit produces in us, to exhibit faith in your promises that you've made to us as New Testament believers. And in that way, we can really enjoy and appreciate what it is that Abraham is a kind of father to all of us, even because we share that same kind of faith. And we would thank you for this opportunity, this privilege of living like that. Amen.